The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 101. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is kind of our bond strategist expert, the official Rebel Capitalist Show go-to bond guy. His name is George Goncalves. George, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Great to be here, George.
All right. Now, I am super excited because you just came out with a couple reports that we're going to dive into. One of them is on swap lines. So let's get right into that. And this is going to be a unique Rebel Capitalist Show. I'm going to have the editors throw up some charts, and you and I are going to go through and describe these charts for the viewers and the listeners so they can get a lot of value in this episode. So let's dive right into chart number one. And it looks like it's the foreign official U.S. Treasury holdings breakdown. So can you explain this to us, and what type of data can we extract from this chart?
Yeah, so the first chart that we're kind of going to spend some time unpackaging, it's got a lot of moving parts, and I'm looking at it as we speak.
Yeah, it looks like we start with March of 2000. It goes to March of 2020. And on the left, we go from zero up to $4 trillion. On the right, we go from zero to $2 trillion. And then you're kind of highlighting this point between 2009 and March of 2012.
Yeah, so let's describe what those two... those are the scalings. On the left side is overall treasury holdings from foreign officials. So these are the central banks that they're outside the U.S. that hold dollar reserves, and they primarily hold that, majority of it is in treasuries.
Okay.
And that's close to the $4 trillion mark that you see there. That's the orange line. And then the blue line is the treasury bills component. So that's the short-term treasuries.
Got it.
That they own. And there's a lot of interesting pieces to kind of take away from this. A lot of it's historical, but I do think it kind of sets up for the world that we're in right now. But it also kind of, I also did this to try to dispel some of these preconceived notions in the marketplace that the foreigners own all of our debt. And in fact, actually, that's been slowly, fading away. I mean, there's still a big portion of the U.S. fixed income market, especially the treasury market. But as you can see in the chart, the biggest increase actually took place after 2008 financial crisis. And so the majority of the big impulse of more foreign buyers buying a lot of our treasuries took place after the financial crisis. First of it was in that blue line was T-bills. So they went into like safety, into short-term treasuries. And then the reason why I boxed out the chart in red around the 2009-2012 experience, because that was like really the onset of QE. Like now we take QE for granted. Like it's like any other day there's another QE
Sounds
program.
Terrible to say that, Jordan, doesn't it?
I trust you,
as a given. Well, of course there's quantitative easing. Duh.
Exactly. Back then it was novel. And it was something that the rest of the world was kind of getting acclimated to as well. And you see that the central banks, what I write in the piece, and I think it's self-evident, when the Fed is buying as many treasuries as they were during QE1, QE2, QE3, well, you kind of have like a backstop. And so the other central banks, which are part of this kind of global system, which the Fed is also part of, they're like, well, if the Fed is buying all these treasuries, I should buy them too. And had that really big impulse higher. Now, part of it is naturally happening, as commodity prices go up or as these countries export more goods to the U.S., there's more dollars circulating overseas, and so they have to put the money somewhere. So they'll park it in treasuries. But there's also a lot of intervention that happens when these countries don't want their currencies to get too strong. They will sell their currency, buy dollars, and then with those dollars buy treasuries. Mm-hmm. And that was happening during 2009 to 2012, which led to that huge increase in the foreign official holdings of treasuries. But it was pretty much like 80% of the activity happened in that 3-year window. And we're looking at a 20-year chart, 20-year chart. We're looking at a 20-year chart, and almost the majority of the buying took place during like that kind of peak QE novel period.
Yeah, Yeah, and even going into QE3, it looks like it's still kind of flat line, and even with COVID here. So am I correct to assume the orange line is represented by the left vertical? Yes. Okay, great. And then so that would be right now we're at about $4 trillion in foreign ownership of the long end of the yield curve, and about looks like $500 billion in T-bills.
Yeah, slightly north than that. I'll give you the better scales when we look through the charts. But the key takeaway is that the impulse was pretty quick in 3-year window. It then went sideways, basically, from 2013 until now. It's gone up. It's gone down. It's kind of ebbed and flowed with these key events that I overlaid, you know, with the U.S. election, with oil prices coming down, and there's less, you know, dollars, petrodollars in the system globally. Mm-hmm. Once the Fed had its last hike, actually you saw an increase of foreign buying because they're like, oh, okay, the Fed's no longer hiking. You know, at least our fixed income assets are not going to be impacted by, you know, higher rates. And even a little, it's hard to tell the chart because you have to kind of zoom in. But even before COVID, there was a 2 months or so of increased buying activity.
Yeah. Kind
of peaked up and peaked down. And I have a theory on that one. And my theory, I mean, it's hard to prove.
That's right, a repo, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's actually them physically buying assets, right? So they're buying treasuries. And they're increasing their stock of treasuries, these foreign investors.
Right.
Now, who was, you know, these foreign investors were much more up to speed on what was going on with COVID because it was an overseas phenomenon before it became a U.S. phenomenon.
Oh, okay.
So if you know that, you know, things are not looking too good, what usually rallies the most in a down market? Fixed income. That's my little conspiracy theory, that if there's any sort of connection to why were they buying so many treasuries right before COVID hit? Well, that's the only thing I can explain, is that, you know, either they had an increase of dollars, or they were being defensive because COVID was already happening in January, February, March. Just that in the U.S., we were kind of ignoring it in the financial markets for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But these foreign investors were watching and saying, hey, look, this COVID thing has potential to get bad. And if it gets bad, what does good, you know, what works well in a down market is usually, you know, bonds rally. And so you want to be long the bonds. So it could have been something like that, too.
So have you seen a big sell-off? I think this, well, it goes to March. So have you been seeing a big sell-off at the long end of the yield curve with these foreign entities selling their treasuries to get dollars to pay down dollar-denominated debt because they don't have any dollar cash flow?
Well, initially that was the case in like the heat of the moment during, you know, the first couple of weeks around March into early April. Okay. But then, you know, the plethora of activity between what the Fed has done and all these new programs, which we'll get into, I guess, you know, over the course of the discussion. And they did sell, you know, records amounts of treasuries during both February and April, that they're now, what we can see for the more high frequency data on the weekly numbers, which are not corroborated by this chart, but, you know, some others have pointed out this as well, that, you know, the weekly charts are showing they're coming back in slowly and buying, but nowhere near the magnitude that would actually be noteworthy.
Okay, great. Do you want to hop down to the next chart?
Yeah.
Okay. Go down to chart number 2, and this is USD swap line usage 24 weeks pre-post a big drop. Okay, so just for the podcast listeners, we've got a chart here on the left. It goes from 0 up to 700, what is that, 700 billion? And
yes.
If I'm getting that right. And then we've got the middle is 0 days. It goes to a negative 24 days on the left. And then from 0 days in the middle to a positive 24 days on the right. This looks really interesting, George. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so these are actually weeks going in and out. And the way to think about this, there's three lines. The biggest line is the peak activity during the financial crisis when there was a real acute need for dollars, similar to what we saw in March and April. But that was really, you know, 08 was more about liquidity than this one was. This one was a combination of liquidity as well as solvency risk. And, you know, we needed a functioning treasury market. A lot of the topics that you and I discussed over, and many others over the last 3 months, right?
Right.
It was
right.
A combination of all those three things, which made it even more acute in many ways.
So you're back saying in 08, that was the case back in 08, 09.
Yeah, but in 08, 09, it was that yellow line that I'm showing, which showed that there was even a bigger use of swap lines, and the Fed's balance sheet was much smaller back then. So as a percentage, it was actually huge. The swelling up of the balance sheet primarily driven by the swap lines, and the economy was smaller, the markets were smaller, everything was smaller. So when you scale it back and you think about, you know, this usage in 2008-2009, it was huge. And so we never even got that high. So the green line represents what has happened now, from March through current. The current number is actually a little bit lower now. It's at $225 billion. So it's basically been cut in half.
Way down.
Yeah. So it was, you know, north of $450, and it's basically got cut in half. And it's projected, if no one rolls over these swaps, these other foreign central banks, if they continue to, if their entities at home don't need dollars and they're getting dollars elsewhere, they're going to keep just letting that stuff unwind. And the significance of this is, I guess, there's multiple things to take away from this chart. One, it was never as big as 2008-2009. So therefore, you know, this easily, if you had scaled this, this could have easily been 1.2 trillion, not 400 billion. It could have been 3x. It could have been easily 3x what we saw.
Right.
So that's number one. That's the first takeaway. Two, once it starts rolling over, it continues. It has kind of like this thing where if the funding markets, and if there's been enough liquidity introduced and stability has come back to financial markets, people are not going to go to the Fed to borrow dollars. And so that's kind of another kind of, that's a positive side. The other thing that I showed there, just to kind of juxtapose and throw out there as an alternative view, is like, what if this was just the first inning? So the other smaller gray line, which you barely tell, you know, in the early part of 2008, right before the Bear Stearns event, and like really back to the beginning before Lehman, like before the whole kicking off of the whole liquidity scramble, there was already signs for over a year, roughly, of needs for dollar liquidity. And the Fed was kind of doing it piecemeal, whereas this time they just went all out. They threw everything, every operation they could. They didn't do it like one operation at a time. They just threw all the facilities and new ones in a very brief matter of time. Back then, they were rolling them out more piecemeal. In the early part of 2008, you saw a little bump up in swap line usage, and then it went away for a couple of weeks. I throw it out there as kind of like to like say, like, look, who knows if we're out of the woods yet, right? We've had an amazing Q2. We've had markets, when both the values of markets, of collateral within the markets and assets go up as fast as they've done, that curing effect has knock-on effects too. It makes it easier to like borrow. It makes it easier to source liquidity from the commercial system, not having to go to the central bank. You know, in theory, that's a good thing. But if this is not really fully over and we're not on a sustainable path forward, any sort of relapse, you know, in the economy or any financial risks that start to, you know, prevent, you know, the commercial private sector from lending out dollars, then they're going to have to go, these foreign entities are going to have to go back to the swap lines. Yeah. So I'm trying to make the point that in early 2008, we had a head fake. It went down and then it came back up with a vengeance, you know, when the Lehman, issue took place. So that's the point of this chart. They're like, it could be just a head fake.
With this chart, it maybe, I think what you're saying is maybe we shouldn't be comparing the green line and the yellow line. Maybe we should be comparing the gray line and the green
line. Correct. Because the gray line was so much smaller and scaled to a smaller economy back then. And it felt like it was a temporary like dollar need and went away. And then a few months later, it came back with a vengeance. You know,
so, and then just taking this another step further, if this is the early innings, this green line, like the early innings of the gray line, then that would lead us to believe that the next step is going to be like three times larger than the yellow line. And I'm sorry for the podcast listener, but you just got, maybe I'll have the editor somehow put the charts in the show notes or something like that. But for the viewers, they can see exactly what we're talking about. Is that a reasonable takeaway?
That's what I'm, you know, putting out there as like an alternative view. And like, and that could coincide. These are actually weeks. And so if you project forward, this if they don't roll over completely, then by September, they should be all gone. even sooner than that. Maybe by August, September, this should be all gone.
However, maybe that's the next stage or the next wave or something, huh?
Exactly. So that might set us up for, which also, ironically enough, coincides with a lot of the Fed's liquidity programs have like a September 30 end of expiration date. Although I think they're going to extend all of them, but they almost need like an excuse to extend all of them. So you might get into a situation where, the coast is clear. We don't need liquidity. Fed's balance sheet has been slowly like shrinking as this also comes off. And then we get into August, September, and we realize that, we still do need Fed liquidity. And you see both domestic usage go up for other liquidity programs the Fed has. And for the foreign investors, they might have to go to the swap lines once more. So I don't think they're going to shut them off.
So if that is the result, then what are the knock-on effects for, I would say, the bond market, the stock market, and then the dollar?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, we've had one of the best quarters, in financial history in risk assets, bar none. So it's hard to envision a repeat of that. Although, the bulls will want to tell you, stocks are going to the moon. And this is a new bull market. I don't buy that argument. It was a liquidity injection that's now burning off. And you have that, and then you have the bond market, which has remained skeptical throughout this whole period. Both the credit market hasn't fully recovered. I mean, spreads have come in a lot, but they're not back to pre-COVID. And meanwhile, the only vol that's completely been, kept under wraps is Treasury, Treasury interest rate volatility. That's been, under the thumbprint of the Fed, and it's barely moving, and rates are very stable. So, if we get, and at the same time, a lot of what drives a lot of the dynamics that we look in the markets is the shape of the curve and what the dollar is doing. I mean, in theory, as these swap lines are coming off and people think that they dodged the bullet, but it's actually a head fake, and we get into August, September, and we realize that people are still short-funded dollars, and the Treasury market should, in that environment, be doing what is known as a bull flattening, so the curve will be flattening, which would be the ultimate pain trade for a lot of investors that think the curve has to steepen because of all this debt that's coming into the market. You should, discount, more supply. You should, command a premium for lending long, all that, basic theory. If that gets thrown on its head and we get a flatter curve and lower long-term rates and a stronger dollar, it's going to really put the Fed into a tough spot into September and a few months before the election. So, I think to see a repeat of risk assets do the same thing they did in Q2, that was just the knee-jerk reaction. The ball bounced from the floor. It didn't go all the way up to where it started from. And the bond markets remained skeptical throughout the whole period. And now the question then becomes, if we see a flattening of the curve and the dollar were to rally, not all the way back to where it was, but even just start to rally, the Fed will panic. And that's where it's going to be interesting. What do they do? Do they encourage foreigners to start borrowing dollars for the sake of it if they don't need them? So it's like this weird, it's going to be a timing issue, basically.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for. All right, George, we are at the next chart, chart number 3. This is U.S. Treasury holders going back to domestic-based but not so fast. And on the, down, it starts in March of 1956, goes to March of 2020. On the left, 0% up to 90%. We have three lines here, the blue line, the orange line, the green line. And looks like we've got a lot of information here. So can you walk us through this one?
Yeah, this is actually one of my favorite charts. And I actually shared it on Twitter as well, because I really feel like it's something that people should appreciate, because it's got so many things going on that it's really the history of our modern day financial system.
Yeah, I mean, you got Nixon, you got Plaza Accord, you got everything in here.
Yeah, no, and I went through the painstaking trouble of trying to map out the events that were happening at these inflection points, because things happen for a reason. I mean, it's either a function of fundamentals, a change in regulation, or just like a wholesale regime shift that takes place, like we saw after, you know, Nixon went off the gold standard or closed the gold window, I should say, right? So, you know, if we start from the left and work your way to the right in this chart, I think it's that period is really coming back full circle. I mean, I think, you know, everyone likes to go back to 1971. There's like an interesting chart and grouping that I found. Maybe you've seen it before, some of your readers. It's like, what the F happened in 1971?
Yeah, that's actually I love the those URL guys. Too. WTF 1971. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. And like in many ways, it really does all start back to that. Like the ending of the Bretton Woods system and going to a fiat-based currency, you know, financial markets that we've been based on for the last 45, 50 years, that really is what we are. We started from that, you know, that catalyst. But, you know, along the way, it was not all like, you know, one straight shot. And so what I'm showing you here in this chart is that, you know, pre-1971, the majority of investors in the bond market, of U.S. bond market, were domestic investors, you know, which are the blue line.
Yeah.
And the Fed.
We had savings back then. We
had savings too. We had higher rates. So then we went off the gold standard and you saw foreigners pick up in a very big way. So that first leg higher in foreign investors, it really just took place right after that. Like in 1970 to 1980, basically, foreign investors went from like roughly 3.5% to 5% of the bond market to over 20% of the bond market.
Mm. Yeah, that first gray line, yeah.
You had that big increase. And then you had like along the way, all these little kind of, you know, banking acts that were put in place that, you know, allowed international banks to do more activity in the U.S. during 1978. You had then a period where the dollar started to strengthen massively. And you had, you know, the Plaza Accord in, you know, in 85. But what really, you know, that's like, that feels like ancient history. And the more immediate history, which has been the most relevant, is what happened during, you know, the Clinton administration. You know, the repealing of the Glass-Steagall Act and really encouraged U.S. banks to lever up and to move away from, you know, assets like treasuries into more credit lending and more, more derivatives. And that's what really kind of set in motion some of the things we're still dealing with today. So from that moment forward, coupled with much more active trading by, you know, hedge funds and treasuries, which you can say that that's not fair because a lot of them are within the U.S., but their operations are domiciled in overseas, in the Caymans or wherever, or in the Caribbean. But nonetheless, in this period of like basically like 1992 to like, you know, 1999, 2000, yet another wave higher of foreign buying. So that's when foreign investors went from like about 20% of the market to 30% of the market. You had the Japanese, re-rate the yen in a big way, you know, in response to a lot of pressure from the U.S. in many regards. And what they did with all these extra dollars that they were having, either through us buying Japanese goods or them intervening in the market, they went and bought treasuries. So you had this second wave of foreign investing that it became much more active. It became more like the treasury market moved away from being a savings vehicle to a more trading tool for both domestic investors as well as international investors.
Okay, so we've gone over the blue line, which is the U.S. investors, gone over the gray line, which are the foreign investors. Can you walk us through the orange line? Why is the SOMA portfolio of the Feds important here?
Yeah, and maybe just one last point before we go to
Fed. Sure.
Just because I want to kind of conclude where we are now on the domestic versus foreign.
Yeah.
You saw the you know, which kind of ties back to the chart number one that we had, which showed, you know, foreign official investors had a big increase from 2009 to 2012. It also happened during the period where oil made, you know, new highs, right? We had oil go over $100, $150, $140. That big oil boom is what led to, you know, a lot more dollars being overseas. And that's why you got that big impulse higher from, you know, roughly 2002, you know, really after 9/11, to be honest. From 9/11 to the financial crisis, oil was in, you know, was in a bull market, and that led to more dollars
all
overseas.
Commodities,
and all commodities in general, so a big commodity boom after 9/11, oil being, you know, leading the charge and being the biggest market of them, led to a lot more dollars overseas. You know, domestic investors really got to the lows right there, right into the financial crisis. And this is where it gets interesting, because the Fed is the orange line, right? You know, the Fed traditionally was not as active in the treasury market, other than it grew as currency and circulation was growing. It was kind of just basically matching what was, you know, the stock of dollars in the system. And they would just grow over time, the Fed's balance sheet. In 2008, 2009, before they started doing QEs, some people don't remember this, they forget, but the Fed actually sterilized their easing. They actually sold treasuries to raise money. Yeah, they did a version of QT1 or 0.0. It was a version, but it was used to fund like the FX swap lines, to fund these liquidity programs. Mm. They actually did a sterilization because they didn't want to expand the balance sheet. They were much more, you know, kind of it felt like it was like sacrilegious back then to do that, to expand it. They also didn't have the power to pay interest on excess reserves. They were scared that they were going to put all this money into the system and then it would spill out and create inflation. So they actually first sterilized it, and that's why you see the
and
orange
that's
line
the balance
come down.
Sheet was at $800 billion.
Yeah, and it was $800 billion, but it went down to I think like 400 odd for treasuries, and the other side of it was the swap lines, and the repo facilities. They had all these like domestic and foreign liquidity facilities that was being produced to help, you know, the financial markets kind of clear. It didn't work enough. We had Lehman happen. And the balance sheet, of course, the rest is history. They went 3x, you know, 5x ever since, right? But I think it's important to point that out. And then from 2009 onward, we saw them increase all the way up to, and I think this is interesting, Basel III implementation in the U.S.
Right.
This is when, you know, the regulators at large said the banks, commercial banks, have to own more treasuries in their portfolios. Domestic investors, as well as some foreign too, were doing this in their own jurisdictions.
And this is for these new regulations for the banks, George. Could you just walk us through how Basel III works? And I know they implemented it in waves, but what does that mean for the commercial banks? Like, why do they have to hold more treasuries?
Yeah, so, I mean, post-financial crisis, I mean, there was, as we can see, that there was just not enough liquid paper in the system, not enough, you know, high-quality liquid assets, which they call HQLA. HQLA assets are what's part of the mandate of this regulation, which is part of Basel III, which is called the liquidity coverage ratio. And you have to have enough liquidity for 30 days to be able to sell something that's liquid to raise dollars, so you don't have to like go bankrupt, basically, or, you know, have a disorderly kind of unwind. And that was part of, you know both part of Dodd-Frank, but also, you know, the implementation of the Basel III through Dodd-Frank is what led to these new banking regulations get, you know, implemented post-financial crisis. I just find it ironic that it basically top-ticked when the Fed's balance sheet as a percentage of the treasury market got to its last peak, and it also bottom ticked the low in domestic investors. Like, from that moment forward, the domestic investors took the baton and started buying treasuries.
Yeah, bottom of the blue line, top of the orange line.
And that's interesting, because you can then really conclude with that the repo story that happened in, you know, September of last year.
Okay.
Because they kept buying as many treasures as possible, and they got to a point where they really said, like, no mas. Like, they really said, I mean, you know, commercial banks don't have an infinite balance sheet like the Fed does. They can't just, like, print it out of thin air, and there's limitations on the repo from, like, capital ratios and all these other financial ratios. They just did not have enough capacity to keep buying at the same pace as they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the repo issue, that which we have all covered many times over. But it's all linked back to this phenomenon of who actually ends up holding the hot potato. Like, who ends up holding the treasuries? It's got to be somebody. It's either the private sector, the Fed. And then within the private sector, there's both domestic and foreign. And this tug of war between who's actually underwriting the U.S. government debt is a fascinating story, because we're now at a crossroads, because the foreigners are not buying as much as they used to, as we displayed. And the Fed is now really just on cruise control, buying $80 billion or so per month, but they can always ratchet that up if they need to. And this is where we are. We're at this point now. When does the organic growth come back? Is it just really going to have to be the Fed that underwrites our treasuries forever? And that's really the trillion-dollar question.
Yeah, which would mean on this chart that the gray line and the blue line continue to go down, 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 down to the right, and the orange line just goes up, 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 up.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, BOJ. That's just what happened in Japan. Same exact thing.
Exactly. This becomes a Japanization of the U.S. fixed income market in a very accelerated way.
Yeah, I just... Japan is so much different from the sense that the yen obviously isn't the world reserve currency, so there's not all this massive foreign demand for JGBs, and almost a necessity for JGBs for liquidity in the entire global system. So, I mean, just thinking that through, if the Fed owned, let's say, 60% of the U.S. treasuries, they're not trading. I mean, how would the dollar funding markets work? How would repo work? I mean, how would any of this, like the whole plumbing of the entire global financial system would like seize, wouldn't it?
Well, this is many ways, if you listen to Jay Powell and how he's been describing things really since his 60 Minute video a few weeks ago, you know, they need the balance sheet to grow in order to kind of impart liquidity and easing into the economy to handle the COVID aftershocks, right? But they can't get, they could always get bigger, because this is by no means the peak of where they've been at. You know, I don't have the chart going back to World War II, but they were bigger in World War II. But then that was a real war, but you could argue this is a war too. So the Fed can keep getting bigger. But once you get too big, then you run the risk of what you're basically describing. You're making the dollar, you know, lose its reserve currency status. In a way, it just becomes
because
more.
People just physically can't use it. And I hear that, and I sorry to cut you off, George, but
yeah,
all the time on Twitter or in financial media, you hear, well, there's no alternative for the dollar. There's just no alternative. And I totally agree. I get it. But what if there's no alternative to use the dollar? Like, what if that's not even an option? It's off the table. I don't think people have maybe thought that through.
Well, this is why I feel like, you know, and who knows, because I don't have a crystal ball into the future, but I bring up these long-term charts to kind of put things in perspective. That's been 50 years, basically, since we had a regime shift in the financial markets triggered by the Nixon shock with gold and the, you know, and if we could be, I mean, maybe not this year, but in 5-10 years, whatever the case may be, we're working our way towards a new regime, which will, you know, the dollar will be less of a reserve currency status. I mean, it probably still will be the dominant one, but will it be 60% of overall activity? Probably not, right? And I think this is where it gets tricky, right? Like, how do you do this without, you want to do it in a way where you don't, like, the dollar is a powerful weapon for the U.S. You don't want to lose that weapon, right? I mean, that's still something you don't give up easily. So,
right.
But at the same time, you know, you want to do it in a fair and just way that you don't, you know, just, you know, upend the global financial system, which was kind of bootstrapped on top of it and built around it. So yeah, I think the smart way is that you get some sort of like Bretton Woods too. I mean, if people have discussed that, we need to have kind of a meeting of all the large countries and figure out what is the right medium. Some people discuss the SDR from the IMF. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of that, but there's got to be some new way to create balance. I mean, the crypto people think that, you know, crypto might be a way of doing it. We don't know. My point is, 50 years ago, people didn't expect that to happen either. And it happened. We all adjusted to it.
Yeah. We need to go out and get the URL WTF happened in 2020.
Exactly.
We got to get that right now, George. Hey, go listen, to GoDaddy quick.
Exactly. Listen, that's not a bad idea, by the way. From this moment forward, a lot of these charts are going to go in weird directions. You're going to be like, what happened in 2020?
All right, George. Well, I sure appreciate you walking us through those charts. Those were really, really cool. So much information packed in just a picture. It's amazing. And I can't wait to get you back on the show. But I know you're a little short on time. So for any of my viewers or listeners that want to find out more about you, where can they go?
Well, sure. I mean, at this point, I'm still kind of working out all the kinks. Like I think I've told you before, I do have a website now. I'm still learning how to populate it and organize it. It's just it's the bondstrategist.com, which has some of my older clippings and some of my older pieces up there for those that want to go and take a read of some of the things that I have been discussing for the last 6 months to 9 months. And I'm active on Twitter, as you know, and so that's at bondstrategist. And so for those that are interested in bond strategy, and just kind of follow me there and hit me up with an email, because my email is on thebondstrategist.com. And if you want to be on a future list, let me know.
Yeah, I'd highly suggest following George on Twitter. He's always coming out with amazing charts. And you've got a lot of really smart people that are in the comments and going back and forth. And it creates this great kind of brainstorm of content on Twitter for anyone who's interested in macro or economics or investing, anything like that. I can't suggest it enough. So, George, I appreciate your time, and I cannot wait to do it again.
Me too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.